Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Two guys drove to work. Neither guy wore a seatbelt. One guy got a ticket. One guy didn't. The same two guys drove home. One guy wore a seatbelt. One guy didn't. One guy made it home. The guy not wearing his seatbelt didn't. Don't risk it. Click it or ticket. Paid for by NHTSA.
Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, November 3rd, 2023. Secretary of State Antony Blinken meets with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel, urging the Prime Minister to temporarily stop its military attacks on Gaza to allow humanitarian aid to get to civilian Palestinians. But the Prime Minister says there'll be no pause to the offensive unless all hostages held by Hamas militants are set free. In Washington, D.C., the U.S. House passes another of the 12 annual spending bills, this one funding the Department of Interior and the Environmental Protection Agency. But the chances of all 12 bills passing the House and Senate and being signed into law by the time temporary government funding runs out in 2 weeks are slim. We'll hear from the House Speaker and the Minority Leader on plans to avoid a government shutdown. President Joe Biden travels to Lewiston, Maine, the site of last week's deadly mass shooting, to meet with the victims' families and first responders and again call for more gun control. Labor Department out with the October jobs report, 150,000 jobs created. Unemployment rate goes up a bit from 3.8% to 3.9%. And daylight saving time ends this weekend. We'll hear from Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, longtime advocate of stopping forever the switching of clocks twice a year. Story from the Associated Press. The United States urged Israel on Friday to ensure more humanitarian aid gets into Gaza and to do more to protect Palestinian civilians, as Israel's prime minister said there would be no ceasefire in the nearly month-old war until Hamas releases hostages. The leader of the Iran-backed Hezbollah militant group stoked fears that the conflict could widen by promising more attacks along the Lebanon border. Israeli troops tightened their encirclement of Gaza City, the focus of their campaign to crush the enclave's ruling Hamas militants who launched a brutal attack on Israeli communities that started the war. That was from the Associated Press. Israel's Prime Minister's X account, formerly Twitter, posting Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken are meeting for the third time since the outbreak of the war in Tel Aviv. They met privately and are now holding an expanded meeting together with the war cabinet. Secretary Blinken also met with Israel's president, Isaac Herzog, and this was in public.
Welcome, Mr. Secretary. You're a great friend, and we appreciate it, and we respect it. And I want to commend you wholeheartedly on behalf of the people of Israel for your moral clarity, for your incredible speeches, especially the one in the Senate, which gave the clear picture and the real truth as to the fate of the hostages, as to the tragedy that has befallen on our people, and of course, as to the inherent right of the Israelis to defend themselves. And we are hearing from the outside the demonstration of the families. Our heart goes out to them. We understand it. We want their immediate release. And finally, I want to say something with your respect as to the humanitarian and the international law abiding by the State of Israel. So this is a leaflet which we are sending by over 1,200,000 leaflets to the citizens of Gaza. We've carried out 6 million text messages and 4 million phone calls to the citizens of Gaza according to the rules of international law, where we alerted the citizens in advance, including before the Jabalia attack. Please move out, because as we have the right for self-defense, we want you to go out of the premises from where missiles and guns and bombs and mortars are shelled at our people. and from where the horrendous, atrocious attacks went out. So you move out so we can go in according to international law and defend our people. 6 million text messages and 4 million phone calls and 1.2 million pamphlets and phone calls in addition to all of that speaks for itself as we protect the civilians moving out to safe zone, giving them the right and necessary humanitarian aid, and enabling ourselves to defend ourselves. Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
Well, thank you, Mr. President. And it's always good to be back in Israel. These are difficult days, but we're here as we've been and as we will remain in solidarity with Israel. We stand strongly for the proposition that Israel has not only the right, but the obligation to defend itself and to do everything possible to make sure that this October 7th can never happen again. And at the same time, as you've just made clear, how Israel does this matters, and it is very important that when it comes to the protection of civilians who are caught in a crossfire of Hamas's making, that everything be done to protect them and to bring assistance to those who so desperately need it and who are not in any way responsible for what happened on October 7th. So we're working on all of that together, but we have a shared determination, and that determination will not wane. We also are thinking every single moment of our hostages. So many Israelis, Americans, other nationals, and we are determined to do everything that we can to bring them back safely, to bring them back to be with their families and loved ones. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go. Yeah, sure.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken and the Israeli President Isaac Herzog today in Tel Aviv. Later, after Secretary Blinken's meetings, including with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Secretary Blinken held a news conference and talked about what was accomplished.
We provided Israel advice that only the best of friends can offer on how to minimize civilian deaths while still achieving its objectives of finding and finishing Hamas terrorists and their infrastructure of violence. Today, I spoke with Prime Minister Netanyahu and other senior officials about concrete steps to do that. President Biden has consistently stressed the need for Israel to operate according to international humanitarian law. I also emphasize that the protection of civilians must take place not just in Gaza, but also in the West Bank, where incitement and extremist violence against Palestinians must be stopped and perpetrators held accountable. Third, we need to substantially and immediately increase the sustained flow of humanitarian assistance into Gaza and getting American citizens and other foreign nationals out of Gaza. Since we reached agreement with Israel, Egypt, and the United Nations 2 weeks ago on mechanisms to enable humanitarian aid to begin reaching civilians in need, we have scaled up deliveries. We've gone from zero to now over 100 trucks going into Gaza through the Rafah crossing every day. But this is still not enough. I spoke to Israeli leaders about tangible steps that can be taken to increase the sustained delivery of food, water, medicine, fuel, and other essential needs, while putting in place measures to prevent diversion by Hamas and other terrorist groups. We've identified mechanisms to enable fuel to reach hospitals and other needs in the south. Israel has raised appropriate concerns that we share, about Hamas's hoarding and siphoning of fuel in northern Gaza. Again, its cynicism knows no bounds, denying fuel itself that it has to hospitals and other places that desperately need it. In meetings with regional partners, I'll continue conversations about getting assistance to flow, including with help from the United Nations. Over the last several days, U.S. citizens, foreign nationals, and critically wounded Palestinian civilians have begun to transit out of Gaza. We expect more to leave over the coming days. Even as these people are able to exit Gaza, we remain relentlessly focused on securing the release of hostages, including American citizens.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken at a news conference in Tel Aviv, part of his opening statement. More from the Associated Press article. Ever since the October 7th assault, there have been concerns the conflict could ignite fighting on other fronts, and Israel and the Iranian-backed militant group Hezbollah have repeatedly traded fire along the Lebanon border. In his first public speech since the war began, Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah said his group had entered the battle with the past week's unprecedented cross-border fighting. He said, "We will not be limited to this," suggesting escalation was possible. Still, Nasrallah stopped short of announcing that Hezbollah is fully engaged in the war. Reporting from the Associated Press, Secretary Blinken was asked about that speech.
With regard to Lebanon, with regard to Hezbollah, with regard to Iran, we have been very clear from the outset that we are determined that there not be a second or third front opened in this conflict. President Biden said on day one to anyone thinking of opening a second front, taking advantage of the situation, don't. And we backed up those words, not only with work that we've done with many partners in the region to reinforce that message, but with practical deeds, including the deployment of two aircraft carriers battle groups to the region, including with action that we've taken, for example, against missiles coming from Yemen in the direction of Israel, shooting them down, including as well with strikes that we took in response to multiple attacks on our personnel in Iraq and Syria, who were there, as I said earlier, to try to prevent a resurgence in the region of ISIL, of Daesh. We remain absolutely determined in that effort, and I'm not going to get into hypothetical situations, but all I can say is we're committed to deterring aggression from any part, and we'll take steps necessary to deal with it.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Tel Aviv. You can find his full news conference, runs about a half hour, at C-SPAN's video library at cspan.org. Secretary is scheduled to go on to Amman, Jordan, and then over the next week, he'll continue an overseas trip in other parts of the world, Tokyo, Japan, Seoul, Korea, and New Delhi, India. Story from the Times of Israel. In a brief televised statement before the start of Shabbat, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he has told visiting U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken that he rejects any temporary halt to the fight against Hamas that does not include the release of our hostages. He also says Israel will not enable the entry of fuel to Gaza. Netanyahu begins by promising that victory will be sharp and clear and will resonate for generations. He says Israel's enemies aim to destroy the country and will fail. That from the Times of Israel. The Prime Minister spoke to the nation in Hebrew. Here is the video and audio from I-24 News, Israel-based international news channel, providing the English interpretation.
I met this morning with Secretary of State Antony Blinken. I appreciate his visit here. I appreciate the continuous support of President Biden, the American administration, and the American people. I showed to the Secretary of State a movie, a video from the cameras that were there on the Gaza border. And one of the terrible things is the two brothers seeing their father being murdered, and one of them loses his sight. He calls his mother. He calls for his mother, and those are just some of the horrors in that video. I made it clear that we will continue with all the force, and we refuse to any ceasefire that will not include the liberation of our hostages. We will not pass money to the Gaza Strip. Citizens of Israel, since the beginning of this terrible war on that terrible Saturday, we lost hundreds of citizens, fighters, soldiers, people from the security establishment, the police. We lost incredible fighters, incredible Israelis, best of the best of this country, people who stopped with their own body, sometimes with their fingernails, these monsters.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a televised speech after meeting with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Israel. An update on the status of emergency U.S. aid to Israel. The Republican-controlled U.S. House of Representatives passed a $14.3 billion bill on Thursday and sent it to the Senate. The Senate's not in session today, but the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says the Democratic-controlled Senate will not pass the House's version. He calls it stunningly unserious, since it also contains $14.3 billion in cuts to the IRS budget and does not include any of the president's requests for aid for Ukraine, the Indo-Pacific, or U.S.-Mexico border security. The Senate and House both return Monday for legislative business. This is Washington Today. The U.S. House today continued working on fiscal year 2024 spending bills for the federal government, passing the bill that funds the Interior Department and Environmental Protection Agency. That took 2 days to finish, dozens of amendments offered. Here's one from Congressman Scott Perry, Republican from Pennsylvania. He proposed an amendment on Thursday to cut funding for the National Endowment for the Arts. You're going to hear Congresswoman Shelley Pingree, Democrat from Maine, ranking member on the Appropriations Subcommittee on Interior, Environment, and Related Agencies, opposing the amendment.
This amendment strikes $186.3 million in funding from the National Endowment for the Arts. According to its website, the NEA is the largest funder of the arts and arts education in communities nationwide. Now, this is all well and good. I'm sure all of us here can appreciate the arts. I attend my daughter's concerts. We have pictures hanging up in our home and pictures hanging up in my office. We bought them. We pay for our daughter's instruments. We pay for their instruction in music. We go to the plays when we pay. However, again, we are $33 trillion in debt. We're headed for 36 in the next 18 months. According to a recent report given by USA 2023, in 2022, giving to the arts, culture, and humanity is estimated at over $24 billion. The funding in this bill is a drop in the bucket compared to those private sector contributions, yet it's still important to America, who's careening towards bankruptcy. Furthermore, there have been many debates about objectionable art funded by NEA grants, including nude or controversial topics. Our citizens, our bosses, our constituents shouldn't have to be forced to pay for these things that they find objectionable. One current example is the NEA's current focus on equity, which only divides Americans using identity politics. One way to completely avoid that debate is to stop subsidizing any of these projects. The NEA also operates several programs that, quite frankly, shouldn't exist, including the Art and Architecture Program, which commissions art for federal buildings, and the Arts and Artifacts Indemnity Program, which subsidizes the insurance of arts exhibitions, both domestic and international, including private collections. It's not enough that we pay for it here. We got to spend the money internationally, including private collections. This is your federal government. This is your federal tax dollars, of which we're borrowing right now to pay this bill. We just don't have the money for these programs. I don't have anything against Americans creating wonderful art or enjoying our wonderful art. I am one of them. The question is, should our taxpayers be paying for it? And I don't think that they should. I reserve.
For what purpose does the gentlelady from Maine seek recognition?
I claim time in opposition to this amendment.
The gentlelady is recognized.
I just can't. I'm just so sad that we have to debate this amendment to eliminate funding for the National Endowment for the Arts. The NEA is the federal agency that funds, promotes, and strengthens the creative capacity of our communities by providing all Americans, that is all Americans, with diverse opportunities for arts participation. This very small, $186.3 million in this bill, the small but mighty agency supports arts organizations and artists in every congressional district in the country. And these investments yield enormous economic benefits. My colleague on the other side of the aisle says, well, he pays for his own arts. He makes sure that his family has the arts opportunities that his children's art is paid for. But you know what? Every community doesn't have the funding to pay for their own arts. Every community can't afford arts and music in their school, can't afford these opportunities. And yes, there's private sector funding, but private sector goes to where the private sector wants it to be spent. It doesn't make sure that in rural states like mine, that small towns can take advantage of this. The small arts organizations can have these opportunities. A 2021 analysis done by the Department of Conservation and the Commerce and the NEA found that arts and cultural industries added over $1 trillion to the U.S. economy, supports nearly 5 million jobs, and accounts for 4.4% of the GDP. 4.4%. In what other sector wouldn't we make a lousy 1.8%? $186 million investment in something that was going to add 4.4% to our GDP. These guys would be all over it if it was auto manufacturing or chips or something else. The arts have an incredible value as a positive tool for economic development, education, and community building. Defunding this important agency would cause catastrophic harm. It's a terrible idea. I oppose this amendment, and I reserve the balance of my time.
Congresswoman Shelley Pingree, Democrat from Maine, and Congressman Scott Perry, Republican from Pennsylvania, chair of the Freedom Caucus. The amendment from Scott Perry to cut the NEA funding failed on a vote of 129 to 292. Another Perry amendment to zero out the National Endowment for Humanities also failed on a similar vote. Amendment was offered to the Interior Department, EPA, and related agencies' spending bill that, after 2 days and lots of amendments, passed today on a nearly party-line vote, 213 to 203. It's the seventh of 12 annual appropriations bills to fund the federal government for next year to be passed by the House. And scheduled for next week on the House floor, two more covering Transportation Department, Housing and Urban Development, and the second one, Financial Services and General Government. Fiscal year 2024 is already a month old, and a temporary government funding bill will expire on November 17th. An article in Roll Call reads that Speaker Mike Johnson said Thursday that Republicans are considering a new approach to stopgap funding that would extend pieces of current appropriations for different time periods, effectively setting up a series of funding cliffs while avoiding a single deadline that could trigger a partial government shutdown for all agencies. Here's what Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican from Louisiana, said at his news conference.
You're 2 weeks away from the government funding deadline. Is your plan to move forward with a CR into January, and when do you plan to move on that?
Well, it's yet to be determined. I mean, I think everyone here recognizes that just because we're running out of time, that we may not get all this done by November 17th. As quickly as we're moving the approach bills here, the Senate's a little behind, and obviously we have the conference committee process and all of that. So there's a growing recognition that we're going to need another stopgap funding measure. I've made clear that my initial idea was to extend that to January 15th to get us beyond the sort of the Christmas rush and the things that typically jam us in the House. I think there's some good arguments for that, but some of my colleagues have other ideas as well. One idea that was pitched this morning, to be very frank with you, is a laddered CR. I'll unpack for you what that means here in the coming days, but potentially that you would do a CR that extends individual pieces of the appropriations process, individual bills. We'll see how that goes. I think we can build consensus around it, but I think there's a recognition that we have to complete the job, and we run out of the clock on this, but we want to do what's right with the American people. So stay tuned for further details.
House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican from Louisiana, at a news conference on Thursday. The House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, Democrat from New York, asked about this today at his news conference.
Government funding runs out in 2 weeks from today. How concerned are you about a government shutdown this month?
The American people should be very concerned that the extreme MAGA Republicans have made a decision once again to try to shut down the government. This notion of a so-called laddered CR. Like, the novelty, being delicate with my words here, the novelty of my friends on the other side of the aisle in terms of how they come up with language that disguise their intentions, translation, they want to shut the government down. Because many of my Republican colleagues fundamentally do not believe in a functional federal government which is designed to meet the health, the safety, and the economic well-being of the American people. They're not interested in a functional federal government. How do we know that? Because for the last 25 plus years, Republicans, largely led in the House, have repeatedly shut the government down. It was my hope that under new management, there would be a different approach, and that remains to be seen what will happen in advance of November 17th. But let's be clear. The only way forward is in a bipartisan way to pass a continuing resolution at the fiscal 2023 level. We are not going to allow Republicans to try to impose right-wing cuts that devastate and undermine the health, the safety, or the economic well-being of the American people, because they are unable to achieve their policy directives outside of threatening a government shutdown. We have never paid a Republican ransom note in the context of their threats to shut the government down. We've always stood on the side of the American people, and we will continue to do that in advance of November 17th and beyond.
House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries at his weekly press conference in Washington, November 17th, is when the temporary government funding bill, the current one, expires. Washington Today continues in a moment.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Welcome back to Washington Today, which you can get as a podcast wherever you find your podcasts and on the C-SPAN Now mobile app. President Biden and First Lady Jill Biden traveled to Lewiston, Maine today, the site of last week's deadliest mass shooting in that state's history. 18 people killed and another 13 wounded at a bar and bowling alley by a lone gunman who was found dead after a two-day manhunt. President and First Lady meeting privately with the families of the victims, plus police, firefighters, paramedics, nurses, and other community members. And in public remarks, calling for, as he has many times, for more government-enacted gun violence prevention measures.
We just visited a memorial at the restaurant, and we're here at the bowling alley where we met with the first responders standing behind me. You know, we'll never forget the trauma they experienced. And as I said, can't express how much we appreciate what you did. And also, the members from the nurses and docs in the hospital who took care of these folks. I don't know how they do it. We're also meeting with survivors and families of the victims who will never quite be the same. No pain's the same, but we know what it's like to lose a piece of our soul, and the depths of loss is so profound. Some of us have been there. 18 precious souls stolen, 13 wounded, children, grandchildren, spouses, siblings, parents, grandparents, bowling coaches, union workers, beloved members, advocates and friends of Lewiston deaf and hard of hearing community. All of them live lives of love and service and sacrifice. We also remember the survivors who will forever carry the memories and the physical and emotional scars of this. They should be embraced. I know you will. I know you do. You know, as we mourn today in Maine, this tragedy opens a painful wounds all across the country. Too many Americans have lost loved ones or survived the trauma of gun violence. I know because Jill and I have met with them in Buffalo and Uvalde and Monterey Park and Sandy Hook and all. Too many to count. Too many to count. From places that never make the news all across America. It's about bringing people together. Different voices and perspectives for an honest conversation on what's to be a long road to recovery. You know, and I've been at this a long time, I know consensus is ultimately possible. This is about common sense, reasonable, and responsible measures to protect our children, our families, our communities. Because regardless of our politics, this is about protecting our freedom to go to a bowling alley, a restaurant, school, church, without being shot and killed.
President Biden in Lewiston, Maine today. Among those joining him, the governor and the congressional delegation, although one U.S. House member could not make it, and both of Maine's U.S. senators, Angus King, an independent, and here's Susan Collins, a Republican.
First, let me express my deep gratitude to the president and the first lady for being here. It means so much to this community and to the entire state of Maine. I also want to thank our first responders who are there behind us and all of the federal, state, and local officials who have responded to this heinous killings. October 7th is a day that is seared in our memories, a day of horror and grief, but also a day of courage and compassion. To the families of those who lost loved ones, I offer this proverb. Death leaves a heartache that no one can heal. Love leaves a memory that no one can steal. In their memory, let us continue to support those who've lost loved ones, those who are injured, those who are recovering. As they grieve, let them know that we are with them. And let us ensure that what makes Lewiston and all the communities in this close-knit area so special continues. Lewiston strong.
Senator Susan Collins, Republican from Maine, today with President Biden in Lewiston, Maine. She also said to my friends in the deaf community, stay strong, as she signed, as she said that four of the eight people who died at the bar and billiards hall in Lewiston were deaf. This is Washington Today. Story from the Wall Street Journal. Job growth slowed sharply last month, a sign the U.S. economy is cooling this fall after a torrid summer. Employers added 150,000 jobs in October, half the prior month's gain and the smallest monthly increase since June, the Labor Department said Friday. The unemployment rate rose to 3.9%, up a half point since April, and wage growth slowed. That reporting from the Wall Street Journal. The acting U.S. Labor Secretary Julie Hsu was interviewed on Yahoo Finance.
This month's report shows 150,000 jobs added last month. That brings the total since President Biden came into office to 14 million. At the same time, we continue to see unemployment rates of less than 4%. To your point about the adjustments, even if you look at the three-month adjusted jobs numbers, it's 204,000 per month. Now, recall that over a year ago, President Biden said that if we move from this current period where we were seeing 500,000 jobs a month to a number more like 150,000, it would signal that we were entering this phase of steady, stable, sustainable growth. That's exactly where we are and exactly where he wanted to be. And I think that's a sign that the president's economic policies, that Bidenomics, is really working for American workers and also for the economy.
Acting Labor Secretary Julie Hsu on Yahoo Finance TV. The House Budget Committee Republicans posting on their X, formerly Twitter, account, slow job growth, rising unemployment, and soaring spending, the new normal under President Biden. The solution, stop the endless spending and taxing. Our reverse the curse budget results in more jobs, higher wages, lower unemployment and poverty rates, and an overall improved standard of living for all Americans. Wall Street today, the Dow up 222, NASDAQ up 184, S&P up 40. The Federal Reserve Vice Chair for Supervision, Michael Barr, today talked about the new rules for CRA, the Community Reinvestment Act, that were issued 2 weeks ago by the Fed, the FDIC, and the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. The CRA was first enacted in 1977, an attempt to increase banks' lending and investment in the communities they serve. And its implementing regulations have not been updated since the 1990s. Fed Vice Chair Barr spoke at the National Housing Conference in Washington.
I think the Community Reinvestment Act is really one of the foundational pieces of legislation that Congress passed to deal with redlining and discrimination in housing markets. And it's really designed to help ensure that banks are serving their entire community, including low and moderate income communities. As you mentioned, the last major revision was in 1995, and it's really important that we update the Community Reinvestment Act to make sure it's serving its purpose, that it's actually helping banks to serve all their communities, that it's overcoming redlining and discrimination issues, that it's updated to meet the needs of the current environment that we live in. The banking sector has changed a lot since 1995. There's online banking, there's mobile banking. I think, as you've said, our cell phones in our pockets are our bank branches now.
That's right.
So we really do need to make sure that the law stays up to date, and that's what this revision does. So it updates the law to make sure that banks that are using online and mobile platforms that have a national footprint are serving all their communities. It provides greater clarity to banks and communities about what counts under the Community Reinvestment Act so that the communities can work with banks to find projects that meet their needs of the local community. It provides metrics so there's greater consistency and transparency about how banks are serving local communities. So these kinds of initiatives in the rule are all designed to provide greater clarity, greater consistency, greater transparency, to update the rules for the environment we live in, and really to make sure that CRA is strong and vital for the next quarter century.
The Federal Reserve Vice Chair Michael Barr at the National Housing Conference held at the National Press Club in downtown Washington, D.C. today. It's time to change the clocks again, falling back an hour this weekend, ending daylight saving time and beginning standard time. That's going to last until March 10th of 2024. Senator Marco Rubio, Republican of Florida, posting this statement, "The practice of changing our clocks has outlived its purpose, yet we continue to fall back and spring forward. My Sunshine Protection Act would end this biannual and confusing practice. It is time to lock the clock." He attached 1 minute of his Senate floor speech from 2022 when the Senate did pass his bill, but the House never took it up.
See, it's an eclectic collection of members of the United States Senate in favor of what we've just done here in the Senate, and that's to pass a bill to make a daylight savings time permanent. Just this past weekend, we all went through that biannual ritual of changing the clock back and forth and the disruption that comes with it. And one has to ask themselves after a while, why do we keep doing it? Why are we doing this? This really began back in 1918 as a practice that was supposed to save energy. And since then, we've adjusted it. So we're doing this back and forth of clock changing for about 16 weeks of standard time a year. I think the majority of the American people's preference is just to stop the back and forth changing. But beyond that, I think their preference is, certainly at least based on today's vote and what we've heard, is to make daylight savings time permanent. I know this is not the most important issue confronting America, but it's one of those issues where there's a lot of agreement. And I think a lot of people wonder why it took so long to get here. But the good news is if we can get this passed, we don't have to keep doing this stupidity anymore. And why we would enshrine this in our laws and keep it for so long is beyond me. But hopefully this is the year that this gets done. And pardon the pun, but this is an idea whose time has come.
Senator Marco Rubio, Republican from Florida, in 2022, he reposted his own speech today because in that year, they actually did pass his bill to end daylight saving time. The House never took it up. And this weekend, we again turn our clocks back 1 hour. Congressman Roger Williams, Republican from Texas, celebrating on the House floor today the World Series win of his hometown Texas Rangers. First title for the franchise since the team moved to Arlington, Texas.
Mr. Speaker, for the first time in their 63-year history, I'm proud to say that after defeating the Arizona Diamondbacks in Game 5, the Texas Rangers are World Series champions. I have the great honor to represent the Rangers in Texas' 25th Congressional District. I'm tremendously proud of this team, who not only won their first World Series, but won a record-setting 11 straight postseason road games. Needless to say, this is a historic moment for Texas and Arlington, and it could not have been done without manager Bruce Bochy, series MVP Corey Seager, all the players and staff who left everything on the field, and especially team owners Ray Davis, Neil Liebman, and general manager Chris Young. And most importantly, all the fans, the best in the nation, who showed up to every game decked out in their Ranger red, their Ranger white, and their Ranger blue to cheer and support the Texas Rangers. I'm proud to say the Rangers went and took it. Again, to the staff and players, congratulations. Enjoy the well-deserved celebrations. We look forward to opening day in 2024. Go Rangers and look fastball. In God we trust, I yield back.
Congressman Roger Williams, Republican from Texas, on the House floor today. A victory parade was held for the Texas Rangers in Arlington, with tens of thousands of fans lining the two-mile route near the team's ballpark. Associated Press writes, the Rangers won their first championship in their 63rd season as a franchise, which began as the expansion Washington Senators in 1961, before the team moved to Texas in 1972. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter, word for word, it's free, and get the stories making headlines in Washington, D.C. sent to your inbox every day. Subscribe at cspan.org/connect. Have a good night and weekend.